This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Alex Mchema is one of the partners in this gold-rich area of Mazowe, about 40 kilometers north of Harare. He says gangs with machetes sometimes attack at his low miners.
That was Columbus Mavunga reporting about the violence at Zimbabwe's mines. Details coming up. Also, we will have an update on the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region. And the Netherlands have returned to Nigeria a priceless smuggled antique. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has rebuffed international efforts to start a dialogue with leaders of the country's Tigray region to halt the conflict there. He met today with envoys from the African Union, former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, former Mozambique President Joaquim Chissano, and former South African President Kgalema Motlanthe. Afterward, his office said Abiy appreciated the envoy's concern and that his government must enforce the rule of law in Tigray. The fighting began November 4th after Abiy accused the Tigray People's Liberation Front of attacking a federal military facility. The Ethiopian government says the offensive is targeted at just leadership, while the TPLF says it is a war against the people of Tigray. Yesterday, Abiy said the army was beginning the final phase of the offensive and assaulting the Tigray capital, Mekelle, while he said care would be taken to protect civilians in the city. International aid agencies and human rights groups are concerned about the welfare of the 500,000 people who live there. Already, more than 40,000 people have fled Tigray into Sudan. We pick up that part of the story with Naba Mohadin, a journalist who spoke with VOA's Jason Patinkin from the Rakoba refugee camp on the Sudan-Ethiopia border.
Naba, what are the conditions like in the camp right now?
Actually, it's a very, very bad condition. Despite that, a lot of organizations are trying to assist and aid, like UNHCR. There are a lot of UN agencies and Red Cross. But still, the conditions are very bad because people came here with nothing. They just fled the war. People live in small rooms. Some of them are small rooms and villages, and some of them in the tents. There is a very, very bad health conditions. There is not a lot of medicine here. Pregnant women are suffering with zero health care for them and for their babies. And a lot of women gave birth here in the camp.
And what are the refugees telling you about what they experienced back in Ethiopia?
Everyone has his tragedy, but the common thing is it's a miserable situation. They fled the war, escaping from killing in the streets, brutal killing of the two armies conflicting, the Tigray army and the federal government army. People are scared of the brutal killing. There were attacks, strong attacks against the villagers, so they just fled to have good security situation.
You mentioned attacks on villagers. Who did they say carried out these attacks? Was it the Ethiopia federal government, the Tigray forces, or both?
They said from both forces, and they are conflicting, but there is an ethnic flare that is erupting in the Tigray. Like, the federal government is even like chasing civilians, and not only the Tigray forces. And right now it's morphing to be an ethnic group's conflict more than the two forces are conflicting.
On our show yesterday, we reported allegations of a massacre of non-Tigrayan people committed allegedly by a Tigrayan militia. Have you met anyone there who survived that incident?
Actually, most of the people that I talked to, they are from Tigray region and they are Tigrayan. I didn't talk to people from other ethnic groups.
Got it. So can you tell me about some of the survivors who you have spoken with? What are they telling you?
I met a lot of survivors, like small families, contains of a father, mother, and two children. There were some families, they lost some of their family members in the way. Some women lost their children. A lot of people say like they lost their cousins and neighbors to survive to come to the borders. They were killed in the way to make it to Sudan. People are talking about brutal killing in the streets, and they are talking about a conflict that is morphing into an ethnic conflict more than just two forces conflicting. With political agendas. They think it's a flare that could lead to a civil war between Tigranian and Oromo people.
And these survivors, are any of them wounded?
I met people with wounds in knives and axes in their legs and in their arms. They are receiving some medical care, but it's not enough. And Tigranian doctors themselves are making small clinics in Hashaba camp, helping their people because they think there is no enough of medical care. Even the doctors, they fled with refugees, and now they are helping their people in the camps.
And what do the refugees say about what's next? What's their message for the international community?
Some people want to stay in Sudan because they think it's safer for now. They don't think the war will ever have an end. Some people want to be back again to Ethiopia to see the war. And some people, they just ask for aid here because they're already very poor people with very bad conditions. Most of them are farmers. So they just want aid from Sudan's government and international community. And they just want aid, like financial aid, medical support and medical care. That's what they want. But I think the majority want Ethiopia to be saved again so they can go back to Ethiopia because they think they cannot stay in Sudan for so long and they cannot start a life all over again.
That was journalist Naba Mohadine speaking with Jason Patinkin from the Rakoba refugee camp on the Sudan-Ethiopia border. And for more on the situation, we go to Lisa Schlein in Geneva, where she reports that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, is in the Sudanese capital Khartoum to review operations aimed at helping growing numbers of refugees fleeing conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region.
Conditions in Tigray are becoming more dangerous, and growing numbers of refugees are fleeing to Sudan in search of protection and shelter. This large influx is putting an enormous burden upon the Sudanese government and aid agencies. The UN refugee chief is meeting with officials in Khartoum to see how his agency can best support the government and meet the overwhelming needs of the refugees. The UNHCR continues to ramp up its relief effort together with Sudan's Commission on Refugees, local authorities, and other humanitarian agencies. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says new campsites are being built and work is going ahead to erect more shelters and improve services. He tells VOA the UNHCR has helped to relocate nearly 10,000 refugees away from the border inside Sudan. However, he notes many refugees want to stay close to the border in hopes of seeing family members who have become separated from them during their flight.
That's why one important service that we humanitarians working with authorities are providing is family tracing services. We have been able to get some family members reunited, but worries are there that many are left behind. And those who are fleeing, they talk about the conflict, hearing gunshots. Some have just fled even before in the anticipation of the conflict reaching them.
The UNHCR is raising concern for the safety of civilians caught in conflict inside Ethiopia's Tigray, particularly in the capital Mekele, home to more than 500,000 people. These concerns are widely shared by humanitarians and activists since the Ethiopian Prime Minister announced plans to launch a so-called final phase in Tigray's northern region. Fearing many civilian casualties, the United Nations is warning of possible war crimes if the Ethiopian army attacks Mekele. Baluch says the worsening situation of some 96,000 Eritrean refugees in four camps in Tigray is also very worrying. Before the start of the conflict in early November, he says the UNHCR had regular access to the refugees.
Since the start of it, we have lost access. We had done, and these refugees rely on humanitarian distributions. We had done the distribution we had done before the start of the conflict, according to what they have had, is they will be running out of food as of Monday.
The UNHCR is calling for unconditional and unhindered humanitarian access to reach these desperate people with life-saving aid as soon as possible. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Deadly violence in Zimbabwe's gold mining sector was a problem for years until COVID-19 restrictions brought it to a sudden, surprising halt. Now, with lockdown measures gradually lifting, some in the sector fear the violence will return. Columbus Mavunga reports from Mazowe, Zimbabwe.
Violence associated with Zimbabwe's gold mining sector killed hundreds of people in 2019 and early 2020, according to a new report from the International Crisis Group. The violence stemmed from miners fighting over gold or gangs robbing miners at gunpoint. Anok Rijtering is a former fellow at the International Crisis Group who contributed to the report. She says the fighting is crippling investment in the sector.
So it's also important to consider how this violence affects Zimbabwe's long-term prospects of attracting investors. This violence makes investing in Zimbabwe's gold more risky. That means attracting investors with a shorter time horizon. And those who perhaps are wanting to make some quick money, perhaps by engaging in the patronage economy, whereas what Zimbabwe really wants is to have its pick of a spread of investors, including those who provide patient capital, who want to develop mines, etc. And this violence is not conducive to such investment.
Gold is Zimbabwe's largest foreign exchange earner. The country hopes gold mining will help its ailing economy recover after the COVID-19 pandemic lockdown. Felix Mchema is one of the partners in this gold-rich area of Mazowe, about 40 kilometers north of Harare. He says gangs with machetes sometimes attack artisanal miners. He says, at times when they come, we flee. But if it's a night raid, we are in trouble. But if we feel it's too much, we gang up and fight back, he says. They may run away or overpower us. Gold panning is all about trying to look for money for our family's survival, he says. Kazembe Kazembe, Zimbabwe's Home Affairs Minister, who is in charge of police, says the government will not tolerate unrest in the mining sector.
If anything along those lines happens, we are very well prepared to deal with it the way we dealt with it last time. But again, we don't anticipate such illegal activities. We are kindly asking those artisanal miners to obey the law and to do things legally.
And violence has declined steeply this year since COVID-19 regulations went into place. The violence has not returned even with the gradual lifting of the lockdown since August. The International Crisis Group report says if Zimbabwe wants to keep things this way and reduce rampant gold smuggling that costs the country valuable revenue, the government must give mining cooperatives legal standing and pay gold producers the prevailing global rate. That way, it says, Zimbabwe gold can add some glitter to the country's dim economy. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Mazowe, Zimbabwe.
Also, efforts continue in Zimbabwe to rescue more than 20 miners trapped in a gold mine that collapsed in Bindura, 70 kilometers north of Harare. The independent miners were working in the decommissioned Ran gold mine when a shaft caved in. At least 6 miners have been pulled out and taken to a hospital. The Netherlands has returned to Nigeria a priceless smuggled antique in a ceremony in the capital Lagos. According to the French news agency AFP, the antique is a terracotta head, believed to be at least 600 years old. It was taken from Nigeria's southwestern city of the Lil Ilfi and smuggled through Ghana. The smugglers had obtained forged documents to take it out of the country, but Dutch customs intercepted it at the airport in Amsterdam. AFP reports Dutch officials then contacted their Nigerian counterparts, leading to the return of the artifact. Hundreds of Nigerian artifacts, including Benin bronzes, were stolen during pre-colonial and colonial period and now are in museums in Europe and the United States. Nigeria's information minister, Lai Mohammed, said his country will continue to seek their return. Some African governments are concerned that the continent's biggest trade partner, China, is about to scale down its operations in Africa and limit loans and funding because of the economic damage caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. However, some researchers say Beijing seems to want to maintain and even strengthen cooperation with Africa, but is using new approaches that governments and enterprises on the continent aren't paying the necessary attention to. Darren Taylor has more.
Hannah Ryder is a Kenyan economist and CEO of Development Reimagined. It's an international consultancy in Beijing that advises companies around the world, but especially in China, about investing in Africa. Ryder says it appears as if China wants to be more self-reliant with regard to the goods and services it needs.
It's not clear whether the dual circulation strategy will necessarily involve use of African labor and therefore enable the countries to upgrade their own production and add value to products in country and then export to China, for example, duty-free and without other trade barriers, which is their ultimate aim.
Nevertheless, says the economist, China appears dedicated to bolstering trade with Africa. She points to the free trade agreement Beijing signed last October with Mauritius, the first African country to have such a pact. Beijing's also established free trade zones focused on Africa in China. These, says Ryder, could be highly significant if they facilitate the duty-free import of manufactured goods from Africa for China's high-end consumers, for example, jewelry, and not just raw products.
But we are still not seeing this really in huge numbers. We're not seeing any Chinese firms, for example, relocating to Africa in order to export to China, even with regards to some of those agricultural products. That in itself, and certainly if they were manufactured in higher added value goods, that would be a real game changer. But it doesn't seem to be what is happening right now.
As for the large debts some African nations owe the Chinese government, Beijing doesn't seem to be concerned about it at this stage, says Ryder.
We see a bigger focus in China on how to reignite growth, including through trade, through foreign direct investment, through completing existing projects, avoiding delays and so on. And indeed, in a post-COVID-19 time, is very important to ensure that all the loans that have been taken from China in particular are focused on productive investments, that they're focused on things like transport and smoothing logistics, employing local
people. She says China continues to invest in Africa despite COVID-19, but not to the extent that it might have. To reinforce her opinion, Ryder recalls the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation held in South Africa 5 years ago.
At that conference, there was a target agreed of $100 billion of foreign direct investment from China into Africa by 2020. And that's clearly not going to be met. And it wasn't going to be met before COVID-19 either. Right now, it stands just over $50 billion.
Beijing continually asserts it wants to drive development across the continent. But Ryder says its investments aren't very diverse and remain clustered in only a few countries. She says whatever China's plans are for Africa, the continent must protect its own best interests and cannot afford to be a passive bystander. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Malawi's new cannabis regulatory authority this week said the country is ready to become the latest in Africa to produce the plant for medical and industrial use. Malawi farmers, however, say the license fee up to $10,000 is high. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The enactment of a law allowing cultivation of cannabis sounded like good news to Yohane Banda, a farmer in Kasungu district in central Malawi. Banda believed switching to cannabis would almost triple his earnings from the tobacco he has been growing for the past 15 years. But now, the license fees required to grow the crop have dimmed his hopes.
It's discouraging because in cannabis growing, to get the license is expensive. They're saying it's 150,000 per hectare. Whereas you are growing tobacco, you pay according to the quota that you have been provided with by the Tobacco Control Commission. For example, the starting quota is 2,000 kgs and you pay 21,000.
The license fees to grow cannabis amount to $10,000 to cultivate and sell medicinal hemp, and $2,000 for the right to grow and sell the industrial hemp. Jacob Nyirongo is the chief executive officer for the Farmers Union of Malawi. He says the regulatory authorities should have first looked at the market price of the crop before setting the license fees.
The question is, if you buy a license at $10,000, what kind of a market price for cannabis to warrant the farmer to make a profit? If you look at the licensing rates for those that do trade in products that are manufactured from industrial hemp, you find that their rates are very low, giving an impression that the law might promote trading rather than production.
The Cannabis Regulatory Authority has defended the fees, saying the expectation is that farmers will operate in cooperatives, not individually. Farmer Banda says registering a cooperative in Malawi is not an easy task.
It cannot be possible to grow this crop by using the cooperative. You know, here in Malawi, even to form a cooperative, it takes a long time. You face a lot of challenges. Paperwork, how cooperative work, to go into government offices and get license of a cooperative, it's a challenge.
Malawi has long relied on tobacco, which accounts for about 13% of its gross domestic product and 60% of its foreign exchange earnings. Over the years, however, tobacco prices per kilogram have fallen, largely because of anti-tobacco campaigns and fewer people smoking. Therefore, growing cannabis is seen as an alternative way of helping the country diversify its agriculture-based economy. Malawi is now one of 5 Southern African countries, along with Zimbabwe, Zambia, Lesotho, and South Africa, that has licensed cannabis for production. Boniface Kadzamira is the board chairperson for the Cannabis Regulatory Authority. He says the board has so far received more than 100 applications for licensing, which were under review.
The challenge now is we don't have seed in the country that people can use. We rely on the seed that is going to be imported from outside. And those who did the trials, one of them has been given permit to import the seeds. And we are hoping that the seed will be in the country maybe by the end of December. Definitely there will be late growing for those who are ready to start.
In the meantime, the government says it will consider reviewing the cannabis license fees in response to concerns from farmers and other stakeholders. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.